Happy New Year!
I thought I hid all of those.
Not well enough, apparently.
Well, 2020 is off to a smashing start.
Yeah, this is really going to be my year.
How do you figure?
Well, I broke a mirror back in 2013, so logically, this is the year when things start to turn around.
Well, here's to no more water damage to your condo in 2020.
Hear, hear.
Do you want to throw some salt over your shoulder, too?
I think you're only supposed to do that if you spill salt or knock over a salt shaker.
Wait, do people think that spilling salt brings bad luck for some reason?
Well, I guess because salt was such a valuable product and such an important part of people's diet. I mean, spilling it was, you know, essentially seen as a bad omen.
Is that why you don't have any salt shakers in your house? Or is it simply because you don't cook?
Look, I need all the good luck I can get.
Hmm. Oh, well, now I feel bad about the cats.
The cats?
Yeah. I let a small army of black cats loose in your apartment. That's almost certainly going to bring bad luck.
Well, not necessarily. If I get a few litter boxes, I should be able to... Oh no, my couch!
Yeah, I was reading this vet's blog, and I've really come around on declawing. It's just inhumane.
Do you guys ever pay attention to salt and what you eat or anything like that? Or you just don't care?
Actually, I don't care. I don't have high pressure, so...
There you go.
I don't need to.
Hi, this is David Lonstein, and I'm here at the Atwater Market going to ask people about salt and how they consume it.
Do you have any opinions about salt? Do you try to avoid salt, or you just spend the whole day?
Oh, I'm trying to reduce salt, actually, because you know, it's like the same movement that you had for sugar, right?
Yeah.
But now it's all about the sodium.
Right. Do you guys know what high amount of salt does to you? Like, why is it bad and everything?
Raises your blood pressure.
Yeah.
And heart and stroke and all that stuff.
A lot of medical concerns.
Yeah,
exactly. You would require more water. That's why you bloat.
You pee more.
Oh, okay.
You pee less because you need more water in your body because you have more sodium.
We're having a very heavy urine debate. And there's a daily limit in the amount of salt someone can have. Like, you can have more than that, but it's not good for you. A recommended daily limit. So I'm going to list some food items. I want you to tell me how much percent of that daily limit you think it takes up. All right, so we'll start with a Perrier carbonated mineral water, a half a liter. How much salt intake of your daily limit?
Perrier or what?
Salt carbonated water, so Perrier sparkling water.
Sparkling water?
Sparkling water.
Wait, salt and sparkling water?
I feel like there shouldn't be any. 8%.
Final answer?
Yeah. Zero.
It's actually 3%.
In a Perrier?
Yeah, no, mineral water, 3%.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, McDonald's medium fries, how much percent do you think that takes up of your daily limit?
200%.
Yeah, just too fast.
Yeah. Like, 30%
only?
I would say 80%.
80%.
Oh, God.
There's a lot.
Thousands.
Yeah,
that percentage has to be 60?
69%.
It's 11%.
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding you at all. 100% serious. 11%. Actually, it's only
11%. Ah, okay. I'm fine then.
Now, you know, 11% of your daily value fries. It's, I don't know, fine's the word I'd use. Sun-made cinnamon swirl raisin bread. Two slices of bread.
Bread's pretty high. I don't know, maybe 5%?
It's actually the same as the McDonald's. It's 11%.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Soy sauce, like with sushi and everything? Yeah. The soy sauce, that's 30% less sodium, the low-salt soy sauce. How much do you think is in one tablespoon?
A lot. 60.
60?
I would say. No.
45.
20.
20.
Yeah, 22.
In a tablespoon, there's like 1,000 milligrams of sodium in regular soy sauce.
I took nutrition last year, but I can't remember.
How much do you think of your daily intake comes in a tablespoon of that?
You're baiting me.
I'm baiting you
a little bit.
You're baiting
me. I know you're baiting me. I'm going to say 9.3%.
23%.
See?
I
went high. You went low.
We're not on the same
side.
All right. Last one.
You got to sync up.
Ready. So Lipton's chicken noodle soup powder, the ones you mix together and make a soup, a quarter of that powder, 25% of that, how much do you think your daily intake of salts?
My daily intake percentage-wise, I'm gonna call out to a crowdsource right here. Do we have any
guests? Call for help.
What do you think? What do you got?
A quarter of that packet will be about 50% of your daily intake.
You're going 50.
Yep, I'm going high.
Do I hear it? Come on, you're in college.
12%.
12%.
12. Hobie.
43%.
Okay, hearing all of that, I'm going to go 36.9%.
34%. You were so close. You did it. Yes. Congratulations.
Big day.
You win a business card for this podcast.
Oh, awesome.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Anytime.
It's a show about medicine.
Now gluten-free.
The guy you just heard is Dr. Christopher Labos.
And the other guy is Jonathan Jarry. I'm a doctor, but he's not.
Sorry that I did biomedical research instead. Jeez.
And we're going to look at the evidence behind medical topics. And the show is called...
Wait. No, I want to say it.
I want to say it.
I want to say it. I came up with it. It's the body of...
Body of evidence.
It's the body of evidence.
You totally stole that from Madonna.
Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome to the first 2020 edition of The Body of Evidence, the show whose search engine ranking below Roger Ebert's one-star review of Madonna's Body of Evidence proves that there is no such thing as good luck, despite what the actual rabbit foot I mailed to the Google headquarters was claimed to bring.
One day we'll make it big.
And it was fresh, too. And free range. That voice you just heard is that of my co-host, Dr. Christopher Labos, cardiologist, epidemiologist, and perpetual optimist.
And sitting to my left, as always, is Jonathan Jarry, podcaster, science communicator, and man who somehow managed to bring 17 black cats to my apartment using public transportation.
I don't know why everyone says that herding cats is difficult. I don't.
Anyway, today we're talking about salt, a bad omen if you spill it, and health danger if you eat it.
Or so we were led to believe, but new evidence has cast some doubt about that.
Well, it's a bit complicated.
It always is. But let's begin with the simple stuff. What is salt? And why do we sometimes talk about sodium and sometimes about salt?
Right. So when we talk about salt, we usually mean table salt, which is sodium chloride. One sodium atom and one chloride atom linked together.
So why does the literature sometimes use sodium and sometimes use salt?
It's just habit. In the US, food labels report sodium, whereas in other parts of the world, they report salt content.
And the terms are not interchangeable.
No, so 1 gram of salt is 393 milligrams of sodium, or if you will, 0.393 grams of sodium.
So you have to do some math depending on which report you're reading.
Yes, but remember, math is fun.
Jury is still out on that one. So is all salt sodium chloride then?
Pretty much, yes. Now, a small amount of sodium can come from other sources like sodium bicarbonate, which is baking soda, or monosodium glutamate, which is MSG.
Oh, I remember MSG. That was a fun time back in the 80s and 90s when people thought MSG was going to kill us all. Chinese restaurant syndrome.
Yeah, it really was the gluten of its era. But, you know, anyway, MSG doesn't consistently provoke symptoms when tested in a double-blind randomized fashion.
Right, but it does contribute sodium to one's diet.
Yes, but it's a pretty minor contributor. I mean, most sodium consumed, at least in North America, is in sodium chloride or table salt, not from other sources.
And most of the salt we consume is in our food.
Yes, now, some of that is in there naturally because sodium is critical for life. Our cells need sodium for electrical signaling and many other functions. So if you eat any living thing, be it plant or animal, there is sodium in there.
But most of the sodium we eat is added to our food, right?
Right. So about 4% of sodium is found naturally in food, but the rest is added in afterwards. Around 13% of sodium is added during cooking or while eating.
And that's the cooking that people do at home.
Right. And about 15% of the sodium that we eat comes from eating out in restaurants.
Because restaurants add stuff like salt and sugar and fat to make the food taste better and make us all mere mortals think that we could never cook food as good as this. So why even try?
Exactly. So eating out at restaurants or ordering in means you're going to consume a lot of sodium.
And the rest?
So the rest, about two-thirds of our sodium intake comes from processed foods we buy at the grocery store.
So the all-natural crowd was right all along? Well, there goes my worldview.
No, it's more about like prepackaged foods and stuff like soup that come in cans. I mean, those have a lot of salt in them.
So the greatest source of sodium in our diets is processed or ultra-processed foods. Things like chips, french fries, cake, instant soup.
Yeah, I mean, amazingly enough, science has once again proven that junk food is bad for you.
I'll call the Nobel Committee.
Indeed. So and anyway, look, the best way to avoid salt is to avoid these ultra-processed foods.
Can we replace the salt with something else?
Well, I mean, when you cook for yourself at home, then yes, you can replace the salt with other spices to make the food taste good. I mean, really, there's no problem there.
Are you saying that paprika is a solution to all of life's problems?
You know, funny how often that happens. But yeah, look, apart from that, there's no real salt substitute like there is with sugar and those artificial sweeteners.
We need artificial salteners. What about using sea salt instead of regular table salt? I mean, that's healthy because it comes from the sea, and the sea is a source of all life, something, something.
Right. So, I mean, sea salt is just regular salt. It's sodium chloride. There's nothing special about it. It's just that instead of digging it up from the ground, they boil seawater and the water evaporates, leaving the salt behind.
Basically, reverse desalinization.
Exactly.
But wouldn't there also be other minerals left behind when the water evaporates, like all the other minerals dissolved in water, like calcium and magnesium?
Yeah, totally. And that's why there's a slightly different taste between different brands of salt. It's the difference in mineral compositions because, you know, there are trace amounts. Sea salt is basically just sodium chloride, just like table salt, with a few other minerals mixed in tiny quantities.
So there's no real difference between sea salt and regular table salt?
Not really. I mean, sea salt tends to be coarser because they don't process it down into fine granules. So if you're cooking with it, maybe that matters to you. Also, they don't add iodine to many brands of sea salt like they do with the table salt.
Well, I would rather not get a goiter, so...
I mean, you know, there's another product that you see advertised a lot, and that's pink Himalayan salt.
Right. So that should be healthier because it comes from far away. And the more exotic something is, the better it is for you. That's just how science works. Also, it comes from Mount Everest, which is like a really tall mountain, so it's closer to heaven.
So actually, that salt usually comes from the Punjab region of Pakistan. And really, it too is just salt. It's sodium chloride. Chemically, there's not much difference between it and regular table salt.
But it's pink. It means whoever eats this is pregnant with a baby girl.
So the pinkness actually comes from the trace elements in the salt, the magnesium, the potassium, the copper, and the iron, which give it a unique taste and a bit of a pinkish hue.
Given that all these products are basically just sodium chloride, couldn't someone develop a salt made from something other than sodium, since sodium is the problem? Like... can there be a, I don't know, off the top of my head, a potassium chloride salt people could use for cooking?
Well, so there is potassium chloride salt, and you can go buy it, and people who have heart disease, heart failure, whatever, sometimes are encouraged to use potassium chloride salt instead of regular salt, but it's not very popular.
How come?
Well, it's more expensive, for one, but it's also the taste. I've never tasted it myself, but it apparently has a very bitter metallic taste that most people just can't stomach.
So it's a salt that doesn't taste salty. What a messed up world we live in.
Agreed. I mean, you know, that and war, but yeah.
Well, since we can't replace salt with anything or war with anything, when we come back, we'll look at what salt is actually doing to our health and whether we should be worried. That's after the break. I could eat some chips.
This episode of The Body of Evidence is brought to you in part by a new wellness brand. It started with a newsletter written on Gwyneth Paltrow's kitchen counter. Now, Goop is a multi-million dollar wellness empire that's making crazier claims and that keeps on getting bigger. Which is why a partnership with American President Donald Trump was inevitable. Pastel colors are out. Get ready for a new orange-tinted line of wellness products from Troomp. You bought that gold-plated, cucumber by Goop. Now you can purchase its matching toilet by Troomp. Our new spokesman was raving about it at the press conference.
Terrific! Synergy! Great stuff!
Be sure to buy our oil of covfefe to realign your lying chakras.
Very good oil. Great guy. This guy, very fine people on both sides.
And sign up for the Troomp newsletter to be the first to know about our upcoming children's wellness line, Kid Pro Quo. Goop by Troomp. Troomp. The first 600,000 customers will get a free one-month trial of the new Troomp Meditation app.
Breathe in! That's it! It's good air! Great air! Now breathe out! Get rid of all of it! All of the air! It's terrific air! The best air! Give it back! Now breathe in again! Through your nose! Great nose! Terrific nose! The best! Simply the best nose. Breathe out. Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome back. It's a good chip. Today we're talking about salt, a thing without which peanut butter would just be creamy gum. We eat a lot of it, salt that is, and most of that comes from pre-prepared foods at restaurants and the ultra-processed foods we buy at the supermarket because they come in shiny packages.
Sadly, buying sea salt or Himalayan salt isn't really going to do anything to resolve any health problems because all salt is basically sodium chloride.
So is salt one of those things that is universally consumed across the planet? Like is this ingrained into human physiology?
Well, I mean, sort of. Sodium is critically important and we can't survive without it. We need about 180 milligrams of sodium per day to survive.
But just by eating food, I mean, you will get that. There's no real danger people will become sodium deficient?
No, not really. I mean, there are specific medical situations where people's sodium levels might be low. I mean, that might happen, but not for the general population.
So what does sodium do exactly?
So it has a few functions. One is to absorb water. I mean, for complex reasons, you can't just absorb water. You need some mineral or something to drag it into tissues.
It needs a carrier, like its own Uber driver. That's the principle of osmosis.
Right. So in the human body, the mechanism by which we retain water in the kidneys is moving sodium from the urine back into the bloodstream.
So there are specific transporters in the kidneys that move sodium into the bloodstream, and water follows those sodium atoms.
Exactly. So sodium balance is how we handle water balance.
So that means the more sodium you eat, the more sodium your body absorbs, and therefore the more water you absorb.
Exactly. Salt causes water retention. That's a real thing that happens. Now, if you are young and healthy, more likely than not, your body will compensate and try to pee out the excess water. But with age and with some medical conditions, water accumulation becomes more of an issue. And somebody who eats a lot of salt will retain water.
And that usually presents as leg swelling.
Right. Because of gravity, water accumulates at the lowest point of your body, which is, you know, why people get swollen ankles.
Now, the other big thing that happens with sodium is high blood pressure, right?
Exactly. A high salt diet increases the risk of developing high blood pressure. Studies like the Intersalt study back in 1988 showed that link, I mean, pretty conclusively across multiple populations around the globe.
And do we know why that happens?
So it's a bit complicated.
Just because you don't understand something, it doesn't mean it's complicated.
Ha ha. Well, look, no, there's a few different mechanisms at play here. But basically, if you eat salt and retain water, your kidneys are supposed to compensate and get rid of the extra sodium so that your water balance returns to normal.
And for some people, that just does not happen.
Exactly. Some people are termed salt sensitive. It's like the people who are force sensitive in Star Wars, but much less cool. So when these people eat a lot of salt, instead of their kidneys compensating properly, certain systems, like the renin-angiotensin system that controls blood pressure, fail to do their job properly.
Ah, like the people who regulate the sales and advertising of alternative medical treatments. Got it.
Burn. So anyway, certain people are labeled salt sensitive because salt really raises their blood pressure.
So it's genetic?
To some extent, yes. It does seem to be more common in African Americans, in women compared to men, but it also seems to become more common with age.
So a young person can eat salt and be fine, but an older person can eat a lot of salt and see their blood pressure go up.
Yeah, blood pressure tends to go up as we age, and salt intake seems to be a major part of that.
Do we have a sense of how much salt can increase your blood pressure? Or conversely, if you cut out salt, by how much your blood pressure can drop?
So about 10 points or so, maybe a little bit more in African-American populations and people who already have high blood pressure, maybe a little bit less in other groups, but on average, let's say about 10 points.
And 10 points is a lot, I imagine. I mean, on your driver's license, you're done.
Well, look, it's basically lowering your blood pressure from 150, which is fairly high, to 140, which is not perfect, but, you know, maybe the upper limit of normal.
That's almost as good as some medications. Take that, big pharma!
To be fair, most blood pressure medications have been around for decades and are basically off patent, so they only cost pennies a day.
Well, still, we need some sort of straw man to rail against.
Indeed we do.
So what works best, diet or medications?
Well, it's not really either or. You often do both together, and both work.
They've been studied?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in terms of diet, the biggest or the most studies have been done on something called the DASH diet, the dietary approaches to stop hypertension. There's been quite a few studies looking at that particular diet and the reduced sodium component of that really does lower blood pressure.
And do the medications work the same way?
Well, different types of blood pressure medications work differently. A lot of people with high blood pressure take a class of medications called diuretics. And what they basically do is block sodium from being reabsorbed in the kidney. So they lower blood pressure.
The diuretics sounds like, I mean, first, a really bad punk band in the Portland scene circa 1983. But also like this medication should make you go to the bathroom more often.
Well, I mean, some of them, like loop diuretics, things like Lasix or furosemide, will do that. But most other diuretics, like thiazide diuretics, are really just about lowering blood pressure.
And they would work more for people that are salt sensitive.
Exactly. So you may have heard stories about how certain classes of medications work better in African Americans than in other groups. Well, that stems partly, at least, from the fact that African Americans are more salt sensitive than other groups and respond better to diuretics.
Now, these are all well and good, but what we care about is hard endpoints. Does lowering blood pressure actually reduce heart disease and strokes? Because, you know, here at the Body of Evidence, we set the basket at 10 feet. We don't dunk on 7-foot baskets.
So, you know, in basketball, most points are not actually scored by dunking. Dunking the basketball, I mean, is, you know, fairly rare in most games and generally seem to be an inefficient way to actually play the game if the goal is to win. Dunking is usually more about personal glory and playing to the fans than, you know, actual team success. Anyway, so yes, there is research that cutting sodium out of your diet reduces heart disease. Studies like the TOHP, Trials of Hypertension Prevention, there was a couple of those. They showed that cutting sodium reduced the risk of having a heart attack.
So why then have some people been saying that cutting sodium out of your diet is bad for you?
Well, that comes from the PURE study, the Prospective Urban-Rural Epidemiology Study. This was a large cohort study that took place in 17 different countries around the globe.
So it wasn't a randomized trial then?
No, the PURE study was a cohort study, so observational research, where you don't force people to eat anything, you just collect data on a whole bunch of stuff. And one of the things that they published on was sodium.
So because this was an observational study, they didn't randomize people to low-salt versus high-salt diets. They just looked at what people ate normally.
Well, so not exactly. It's actually very hard to measure sodium intake accurately because food naturally contains sodium. So unless you are meticulously recording what people eat, you won't get an accurate intake count.
So they used the dreaded food diaries.
Well, no, they actually used urinary sodium to measure sodium intake.
Urinary sodium.
Right. Because the kidney tightly regulates sodium excretion, if you know how much sodium is coming out of you, you can get a pretty good estimate of how much sodium is going into you.
That assumes you're not on medications like diuretics, which would affect your sodium balance.
Correct. So what you need to do is collect someone's urine for 24 hours, and then by measuring the amount of sodium in their urine, you get a sense of how much sodium they ate over that 24-hour period.
So you have to ask people to
pee into a jar for one day, yes.
And people agree to this?
Well, in the name of science, yes.
But what happens if they forget to collect their pee one time?
Well, then the whole thing is ruined and not accurate.
So this whole process is predicated on the assumption that people are going to carry around a jug and collect their urine for a whole day and not forget or miss a sample or forget the jug at home when they get to work or not have to pee and poop at the same time or...
Well, look. There's a lot of ways this can go wrong. When you do it right, a 24-hour urine collection is a good way to measure sodium intake, but you have to do it right.
And did they do the 24-hour urine collections right in the PURE study?
Well, they didn't actually do that. They didn't use 24-hour urine collections. They collected urine once, what we call a spot urine sample.
What was their justification?
I don't know. Too difficult, maybe? I mean, it's hard to get people to collect their own pee. I mean, I keep asking you to do it, and you keep refusing.
I'm a very private person, Chris. Maybe in a few years. So how good is a single urine specimen compared to a 24-hour collection?
So-so.
Like, what are we talking about here?
Well, when you compare them, the correlation coefficient is 71%, where 100% is perfect correlation and 0% is, you know, garbage.
So let me make sure I got this straight. The conclusions of the PURE study about salt are based on non-randomized data, not by measuring how much sodium people ate, not by measuring 24-hour urine collection, but by using single urine collections and extrapolating out.
Yeah.
And did people criticize them over this?
I mean, you know, quite a few people did.
What was their response?
Basically, shut up. Let's see you do better, dingus. I'm paraphrasing slightly.
Okay. I'm almost certain their response was more nuanced, but the results, despite these limitations, made quite a splash, didn't they? Because they were arguing that while high-sodium diets are bad, low-sodium diets are also bad. Like, there was a U-shaped association where risk goes up at both low and high levels of sodium intake, like some salty Goldilocks association.
Exactly. I mean, the problem with that conclusion is, first, how they measured the sodium intake with their urine samples, and second, that their findings are not really consistent with all the other literature on the subject.
But Chris, this is the type of research that blows everything away and tells us to forget everything we thought we knew. It's groundbreaking.
Or more accurately, an outlier. The other possibility, of course, is that this is reverse causation. If people at high risk for heart disease eat less salt to control their blood pressure, it's not that low-salt diets cause heart disease, it's that people with heart disease eat low-salt diets.
Right, right. Also, aren't there populations that eat very little sodium as part of their diet?
Yeah, I mean, the Yanomami tribe of Brazil eats very little sodium, less than 0.2 grams of sodium per day. And they're fine, actually. They have, you know, very few cases of high blood pressure and seem pretty healthy from a cardiovascular point of view.
They probably don't see the news. Mm. And if the pure results were true, you would expect them to have much higher rates of cardiovascular disease.
Right. And though we don't have much data on them long term, that doesn't seem to be true.
So has a salt thing turned into a controversy? A salt-troversy, perhaps?
Yes, the salt wars. There are basically two groups of researchers.
No, it starts with the dead speak.
What?
The opening crawl to Rise of Skywalker. It starts with the dead speak. Something about Emperor Saltine being back and wanting his pound of salt. Anyway, you do your version of the story. The salt wars, then.
Right, so two groups of researchers.
The First Order and the Resistance.
Anyways, you have two groups of researchers. One thinks salt is bad and says that everybody who doesn't agree with them is being paid off by the salt industry. The other group says that the evidence is uncertain and that everybody who doesn't agree with them isn't practicing evidence-based medicine.
People are getting very angry over this. Like with Star Wars.
Exactly. So John Ioannidis wrote an editorial about this, basically saying that this type of tribalism, where you belong to one camp or another, is not helpful and doesn't help resolve controversies.
Really? Because they made all of Rian Johnson's stuff go away and it totally resolved... Oh, no, wait, never mind. You're free of your contract now, John Boyega. Speak your mind.
So anyway, to resolve this controversy, Daniel Jones called a mini-meeting among six researchers from both camps to find a way forward.
The Salt Summit. Was it called the Salt Summit? I want to call it that.
Actually, I think people did call it the Salt Summit. So they met and they came up with a plan and published their consensus statement in the journal Hypertension.
Okay, what was the plan?
To experiment on prisoners.
Seriously?
Yeah, that was their plan. They wanted to do a large randomized trial to settle the issue, and so they needed a situation where they could control what people eat. And so, prisons.
Because the prisoners aren't going anywhere, and they have to eat what you give them, which ensures complete compliance with the trial protocol.
Exactly.
Couldn't they do the trial in some other controlled setting, like a nursing home or a military base or something?
Because experimenting on the elderly or on soldiers is somehow less bad?
Hey, we got Captain America, didn't we?
Mm.
I mean, marginally.
Well, look, the problem with the elderly is that they take so many medications and have pre-existing conditions that would skew the results. And soldiers are generally young and healthy and probably wouldn't experience any heart disease or strokes during the trial, so the results wouldn't mean anything.
I see. So is this prisoner trial going ahead?
Unclear. It also came out later that some of the funding was coming from the salt industry and that may have ruined everything.
Salt ruins everything. So is experimenting on prisoners our only option?
Well, I mean, look, a randomized trial would settle the issue, but I personally think there's enough data already to be pretty certain that high sodium diets are bad for you. What target should you aim for? Is it 3 grams per day? Is it less? Should it be relaxed? I don't know, but I don't think it matters.
Because people can't accurately measure how much sodium they eat anyway.
Exactly. Telling somebody to eat less than 3 grams of sodium per day means nothing on a practical level. People don't measure out their sodium.
much more useful to tell people to avoid sodium by eating healthy food.
Exactly. Eat less ultra-processed foods, less prepackaged foods, and eat out less, and you'll consume less sodium and be healthier overall regardless, because that food is not good for you for multiple other reasons too.
So eat less sodium by eating less junk.
Eat less sodium by eating less junk.
Eat less sodium by eating less junk.
And don't experiment on prisoners like the Nazis did.
Eat less sodium by eating less junk. 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 And don't experiment on prisoners like Nazis did.
When we come back, a new study on a type of abnormal heart rhythm involves something most people are going to say no to, abstaining from alcohol. That's after the break.
This episode of The Body of Evidence is brought to you by Dr. Ron Collywobbles and his new book, Reversing Everything, How I Developed X-Ray Vision and My Own Iron Man Suit After Making Revolutionary Discoveries in the Laboratory of Life. Here's him answering questions during his book tour.
My own mother was 85 years old, and she had dementia and rickets and two hip fractures and diabetes and terminal cancer. And really the worst split ends I'd ever seen. Her hair just didn't have the vigor it once had, which was really the thing that was behind her decade-plus depression. And you know, now she's a competitive diver who travel with me to Iceland and Antarctica and Mogadishu. She's planning an ascent of Mount Everest in the coming months. Her life has been changed. It's like the clock of life has been rewound multiple times for her. She started taking the 7 supplements that I list in my new book. That's the only change that took place. Obviously, I can't say that's what caused the reversal, but she is now taking the 7 supplements listed on page 726 and also available on my website. I mean, she is literally running with the bulls in Pamplona right now at the age of 86. And I'd like to think she's giving the bulls a good run for their money, so to speak. Page 726. Buy my book. Welcome back to The Body of Evidence. So you told me that some researchers told a bunch of Australians to stop drinking alcohol. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, they wanted to test the theory that alcohol is not good for your heart, specifically with respect to an arrhythmia called atrial fibrillation.
Okay, more commonly known as AFib.
Yeah.
In our last interview on CPR, we talked a lot about ventricular fibrillation, right, or VFib.
Yeah.
So that's the bottom chambers of the heart. But now you talk about the top chambers of the heart.
Right. So when the electricity in the upper chambers of the heart becomes irregular and chaotic, the upper chambers of the heart don't squeeze properly.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem with that, it doesn't really affect your heart function in a major way. It has some implications.
Your heart is still pumping blood.
Heart is still pumping blood. Most people don't feel the arrhythmia when it happens.
Hmm.
Some people do, but the majority don't. The only thing that happens with your heart is that because the electricity is so erratic, your heart is beating very, very quickly, but it's still beating.
Hmm.
You're still pumping blood.
Right.
So some people feel the fast heart rate. The biggest risk factor, though, with this is that because the upper chambers of the heart are not squeezing properly, they're fibrillating, they're sort of staying uncontracted, blood is sort of pooling in the upper chambers of the heart, and when blood pools, it can clot, and that clot can then go off and cause a stroke. So the biggest
risk...
It can move
out of your heart somewhere else and then into your brain.
That's right. It goes from the upper chambers of your heart to the lower chambers of your heart, gets pushed out of your heart with the blood, and then it goes up your aorta and then up your carotid arteries into your brain, and it can cause a stroke.
Right.
So people who have atrial fibrillation need to take blood thinners.
And so AFib is something that this new Apple Watch, for example, is supposed to be detecting and supposed to be quite useful in that regard, right?
That's right. So the Apple Watch has a diagnostic feature where it can measure your heart rhythm and it can tell you if you're developing atrial fibrillation. It's basically a miniaturized version of technology that sort of already exists. I mean, we do have heart monitors that people can wear when you're trying to diagnose something. The benefit of the Apple Watch is that you can wear it all the time. The problem with the Apple Watch is that it's unclear that screening an entire population for AFib is going to be beneficial.
Especially of mostly young, rich, healthy people who can afford the Apple Watch.
That's right. So people who are, exactly like you said, most of these people are young and healthy. The prevalence, the probability that they're going to have AFib is very, very low. Mm-hmm. So you're going to get a lot of false positives.
Right.
Now, at what point does that become cost effective or not? It's somewhat unclear. Most people think that screening the whole population for AFib by making everybody get an Apple Watch is not going to be beneficial. Mm-hmm. That being said, if you're somebody for whom your doctor says, if you're having symptoms, palpitations, and you want to have some way to check your heart rhythm at home without wearing a bulky apparatus, then the Apple Watch might be a way to go about it. But there are actually cheaper alternatives if you want to do that. You can get small devices. I don't want to plug any particular company, but the one that's most popular is called Cardia. They give you like a little strip that you can put your fingers on, and you can measure your heart rhythm there, and it controls it on your phone, which is actually cheaper than the Apple Watch, ironically enough. So there are mechanisms for screening for this type of stuff.
Okay, so putting aside these monitoring devices, what is a link between atrial fibrillation or AFib and alcohol?
So alcohol is a stimulant. Alcohol can trigger AFib, and there is some suggestion that people who drink alcohol, who drink a lot of alcohol, are more at risk for developing AFib long term. And when you look at the evidence, it's actually not even like a threshold effect where you have to drink more than 10 drinks a week or something. Even drinking one drink seems to increase your risk a little bit. So the correlation is about every extra drink raises your risk of developing atrial fibrillation by about 8%.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. So now atrial fibrillation is very common in our society, and it gets more common as we get older because the biggest risk factor is that the heart stiffens and the atria start to change shape with time. And so alcohol is doing a bunch of things. It seems to affect how the atria get remodeled. It tends to disrupt electrical activity in the heart. It causes some inflammation in the atria. It triggers electrical activity. So there's multiple different mechanisms going on there. But it does seem clear that alcohol does seem to make atrial fibrillation worse. It also does other things. Alcohol makes you gain weight. Alcohol can also raise your blood pressure. And obesity and hypertension are also risk factors for developing atrial fibrillation. So there's multiple pathways there. So one of the things, so when people have atrial fibrillation, we obviously treat them with medication. But the other thing that you try to tell people to do is to get their to change their risk factors. Mm-hmm. So
Lifestyle choices.
So lower their blood pressure, get them to exercise more, get them to lose weight if they can. If they have sleep apnea, treat the sleep apnea. And one of the things that we tell people, but that we probably don't focus on enough, is to cut down on alcohol intake. I think most people have this idea that alcohol is good for you, right? Red
in
wine
moderation,
protects your heart.
Yes. We've covered this in one of our early episodes. Yeah. We keep coming back to this. But alcohol is not great for you.
No.
In any quantity.
No, and I think this study is very interesting because what they did was they took, I mean, not a huge study, they took 140 people. And these people were people who drank a lot. They drank on average 17 drinks per week.
Okay.
So it's a substantial
amount. Well, they're Australians. I mean, for them, it's breakfast.
It's breakfast. That's right. they drank a substantial amount of alcohol. And so they randomized them to one group, which was told, keep doing what you're doing. And another group, which was told, abstain from alcohol completely. So the goal was to get them to zero. On average, I think most people, the average was 2 drinks per week. So they cut down alcohol substantially. But what they found was that they had substantial benefit in terms of atrial fibrillation. So the risk of a recurrence of atrial fibrillation. So atrial fibrillation is an arrhythmia, so it comes and goes. So this is something that people can experience multiple times over the course of the day. The goal is to try to limit the number of symptoms. But the risk of having an AFib recurrence over the 6-month period where the study was going on was 73% versus 53% in the abstinence
group. That's quite significant.
Yeah, so a significant decrease, right? And also the risk of...
Again, small groups-ish, but I mean, this is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the risk of being hospitalized for the AFib was 20% versus 9% as well. So, I mean, sometimes when the heart rate is very, very fast, you have to go to the hospital. So it seemed to have a significant benefit to atrial fibrillation and, you know, a bunch of ancillary benefits too. The people who abstained from alcohol, their blood pressure was a little bit lower. But most importantly too, is that the people in the abstinence group had a 3.7 kilogram greater weight loss.
But I thought that alcohol was zero calories.
No, quite the opposite, actually. Alcohol alcohol is a sugar. Alcohol yes. is a carb. So if you want to cut carbs, one of the best way to do that is cut alcohol. There's a reason we call it beer belly and not celery belly. It makes you gain weight.
Celery belly.
You know, so I think this study was interesting because even the editorial, this is sort of an interesting topic in the field of cardiology and atrial fibrillation, the risk factor controls. This study proved that, you know, I mean, a relatively simple intervention, which is telling people to cut back on their alcohol consumption, can have a significant...
Simple for the doctor, less simple for the patient.
I mean, here's the thing. Obviously, people who suffer from alcohol, it's hard, but yeah. Most people don't cut back on alcohol because they don't want to. I think most people could. I think most people have gotten themselves into a habit. Like I had one patient many, many years ago, and we were talking about his cardiovascular risk, and he said, you know, am I drinking a lot of alcohol? Like, I come home from work, I have a cocktail, sometimes I'll have two, and then my wife and I will split a bottle of wine at dinner. And I was like, here's the thing. I mean, the guy obviously wasn't an alcoholic.
Right.
But he's like 1 to 2 drinks before dinner and then half a bottle of wine, which is about 2.5 drinks.
That's
like,
a significant
that's
consumption
like 4
of alcohol.
Drinks. Yeah, 4 drinks per day. I mean, it's not crazy, but it's a lot. And I said, listen, if you can cut that out, listen, you want to have a glass of wine with dinner, have a glass of wine with dinner. But if you can reduce that a bit, you'll lose some weight, your blood sugars will get better. I mean, there's multiple benefits to be had here. Mm-hmm. So I think people don't realize how much health benefit you can draw from cutting down on the amount of sugar that you ingest every time you drink alcohol, which is really what seems to be some of the major, problem with this particular beverage.
So let me ask you a personal question.
Yeah.
Since the beginning of the podcast, you have basically said that there's no benefit to even moderate alcohol consumption. It all comes out of this bias of the never drinkers versus the people who stop drinking because they had health problems. But you still drink alcohol once in a while.
I do, yeah, absolutely. Listen, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, I still eat dessert once in a while, right? You know, we had cake. When it was my birthday, we had cake, right? Cake's not healthy.
It's true.
But here's the thing. You know, you can still enjoy yourself. You can still do stuff. Well, I think the problem is, first of all, the people who are drinking like 17 drinks a week,
excess.
That's a bit much. Yeah.
Yeah.
So do less. It's like with anything. It's with dessert. It's with sugar. It's with the junk food, with the carbs. Try to do less to make yourself healthier. If you want to enjoy it as a treat every once in a while, I mean, that's fine. The goal here is not for all of us to become teetotalers. But just, But I think the problem is, it's not, I mean, it doesn't happen often, but it's not rare for me to have people come to me and say that they are specifically drinking red wine every day because they hear it's good for their heart.
I see. And like they're almost forcing themselves because they've heard this.
I've had some people. I was like, listen, I really don't like drinking red wine, but I'm trying to drink 1 to 2 glasses a day because it's good for me. I'm like, sir, please stop. Please stop. It's fine, you know? It's fine.
It's a pernicious myth.
It's and it just won't go away no matter what we do. And listen, you go to a dinner party, somebody, certainly, if you want to enjoy yourself, have a glass of red wine. Make sure you don't drink and then drive because that's a major problem in our society.
Mm-hmm.
Red wine is not good for you. It's a dessert. It's a treat like everything else. But a treat should be a sometimes treat, not an everyday treat.
Indeed. When we come back, we answer questions from our listeners. And when I say we, I mean Chris, because he's the one with the medical degree. That's after the break.
Do you like medicine that tastes funny and science made easy? Then visit our website at bodyofevidence.ca. Jonathan and I are so much more than disembodied voices. You can check out our videos, our writings, and even an event listing. And if you want to receive an email whenever we post new content, you can subscribe to the website for free. And we promise our website will never ask you to turn your head and cough.
Welcome to the final stretch of the Body of Evidence. Some of our listeners will occasionally message us through our Facebook page. Others will throw questions at us on Twitter. Some will stand outside your window, Chris with a boombox, playing a looped recording describing their mystery boil.
Or write their question on a note, tied around a brick, and throw it through the window.
Yeah. I mean, to each their own. But to answer the questions of non-stalkery listeners, there's Lionel, who asks the following. He's interested in what he calls habituation, though he's not sure of the term He wrote, "Is it true that we shouldn't use acetaminophen, often commercially known as Tylenol, too often as it will lose its potency? If yes, which amount? Is it true of every medicine?" So if I can loosen that pickle jar for you, Chris, I suspect he's hinting at drug tolerance. And I know that that can be true of some drugs, but all of them? What are your thoughts?
Okay, so the short answer to that question is no, you don't develop a tolerance to Tylenol, acetaminophen, like you do with opioids.
I see.
Okay, so there is a maximum dose to Tylenol. It's generally set at 4 grams per day, but I think most people would recommend that you want to be careful about getting too close to that maximum and certainly not go beyond it. Alcohol can be toxic to the liver.
Acetaminophen.
Yes.
Alcohol as well.
Alcohol as well. Sorry. Acetaminophen. I'm still thinking of the previous blog. Yeah.
Yes. Liver toxicity.
Well, and the other thing is that if you combine them, now you're drinking two potentially toxic things. So people do try to kill themselves by overdosing on Tylenol. It's actually a very painful way to die because liver failure is very, very painful. Okay. So be careful about Tylenol. Tylenol is generally recommended because it's safer than other pain medications like anti-inflammatories, which can raise your blood pressure, increase your risk of a heart attack, and generally certainly safer than opioids.
Right, but it's not side effect free, and
it's not side effect free. But you know, and it helps a little bit. It won't help for stuff like acute back strain and stuff like that, and it's modestly effective for stuff like arthritis. So there's been a few studies now saying, like, well, how good a pain reliever is it? Well, look, it's better than nothing.
It's antipyretic. It brings down your fever.
It brings down your fever. It also acts, I mean, the exact mechanism is still debated, but it seems to act via a specific type of receptors called EC1 and EC2 in the brain. Those are the same family of receptors as the endocannabinoid receptors. So that's where a lot of work is being done. So it's an antipyretic, like you said, so it brings down your fever. It does help with pain, but it's not the most potent thing on the market, but it's certainly the thing that you should start with. But you're not going to become tolerant to it like you do with opioids. Because what happens with opioids and with other medications is that if you take high doses for a long period of time, your body starts to downregulate the receptors. So it starts to remove receptors from the surface of the cells. So you need more medication to achieve the same effect. The same thing doesn't really happen with acetaminophen, Tylenol. The one caveat to that is that there is something called rebound headache, or analgesic headache or medication overuse headache. There's a few different names in the literature. But if you take a lot of these pain medications regularly, like you take a lot of acetaminophen or a lot of Advil or all that, you can actually induce a headache because you're taking these medications regularly. And that what you have to do is stop the medications and the headache can go away. So if you have this recurrent pain, you're like, oh, the Tylenol's not working, you have this recurrent headache, one of the things you might want to try is actually stopping the medication and your headache might actually go away.
You mentioned opioids. What are some other classes of drugs where you can develop drug tolerance?
The cardiac ones, generally not. So there's a difference between tolerance and a difference between having a rebound effect. So I'll give you an example. A lot of medications will have a rebound effect. So if you're on blood pressure medication and you have to stop it for surgery, you can see a jump in your blood pressure just before the surgery. That does happen. Generally not problematic. Beta blockers, medications that lower your heart rate, if you were to stop them, again, for a procedure or whatever, that can cause a reflex tachycardia where your heart rate starts shooting up.
Acid reflux medication also. Yeah. You can get, I've experienced this.
Yeah.
You stop it and all of a sudden, whoa, it comes way back as rebound.
Yeah. I mean, antidepressants have to be lowered slowly because if you stop them suddenly, you can have a rebound, not really a rebound, but you can have a recurrence of your symptoms in a very, very severe fashion. So there's a lot of medications where you don't really want to come off you don't want to come off of them quickly because of these effects. But you know, the biggest and the most common group of medications where you actually have actual tolerance, where you need more and more medications, are usually the pain medications like opioids. That's sort of the biggest and most common class that people would be familiar with.
All right. And Margaret sent us an email. If you want to be more like Margaret, you can email us at thebodyofevidence@gmail.com. Her question was, does colloidal oatmeal actually help itchy skin or scalp? I mean, I know I've seen in stores, and I've bought also these these like tubs of moisturizer with colloidal oatmeal in it.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it should work. But what does the research say about this?
Well, so colloidal oatmeal, much like aloe vera, much like anything else, they're basically a moisturizer. They're grinding up a plant. In this case, they're grinding up oats, making it into a cream. They also can sometimes sell it as something that you add to the bath water. And it's mainly marketed to people with skin conditions, mostly eczema.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so for people who don't know what eczema is, you have sort of dry skin. And one of the things that you have to do is you have to apply, one of the treatments is to apply moisturizer. So moisturizer is basically an oily substance that provides a surface coating to your skin that traps the moisture inside. So prevents your skin from getting dry. So people who have eczema, very dry skin, they're often told use moisturizer.
Right. So you wet your skin, you apply the moisturizer, and then the wetness gets absorbed into your skin as opposed to just evaporating out.
Well, because the problem is that washing your hands frequently dries your skin out. Yeah. I think most people know this,
which
right?
is why I never wash my hands.
That's right. Well, it's actually a big problem in the hospital because
I can imagine
you're supposed to wash your hands after every patient.
Yeah, and before and after every patient.
I mean, when I was a resident doing rounds, my hands were always like cracked and dry, always. Like I had to use moisturizer all the time, and now it's a little bit better because I don't do as much hospital work anymore. But so moisturizers are a critical part of eczema treatment. So I mean, does colloidal oatmeal work? I mean, it's a moisturizer, so I mean, in that sense, yes. But does it work any better than any other moisturizer? Well, we don't know. There's no actual studies comparing this brand versus this brand to a large extent because most of these brands have, a company behind them, and it's in no one's best interests to do a study like this because they might lose market share. And these usually aren't small companies. These are usually large companies. Like Aveeno is sold
Johnson
and manufactured.
And Johnson,
no, so colloidal oatmeal, I've seen quite a bit of. The few research that has been done by colloidal oatmeal does seem to be funded by Johnson & Johnson. The other brands are by the other companies. I just can't remember them off the top of my head. Do they do anything beyond moisturizing the skin? Unclear. You see these small studies here and there that suggest this, suggest that. They're basically small studies in, low-tier journals. And, what do these stuff mean? There's really no good evidence there. I mean, it's a moisturizer. For moisturizers, I generally recommend pick whatever's on sale at the pharmacy because they usually all work. If you have a specific brand that you like for some reason, I mean, go with that, but a moisturizer is going to work. The one thing I do want to say is that a lot of the ads that I've seen for colloidal oatmeal were about adding it to the bath water.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a common thing in people with eczema, especially with kids, because kids, maybe they don't like having the moisturizer. It's greasy. They don't like it. What you do is you have them take a bath. You add it to the bath water. And that's supposed to make things better. There was actually a study in the BMJ a year ago or maybe 2 years ago at this point that actually tested these emollients added to bath water and found that they had no effect. So adding the stuff to the bath water, which is what some of these packages are, doesn't seem to do anything for eczema. But again, moisturizer, yes. This particular moisturizer over everything else, no. I suggest pick what's on sale, pick what you like, pick what smells nice. But beyond that, it's not really much to say.
So if it's on sale, buy it. Otherwise, cook it because it's delicious to eat.
Actually, I think it's a different type of oats that they use for the colloidal oatmeal compared to what they serve. I think it's a different species of oats. They've made that point in a few things.
Don't cook your moisturizer.
Yeah, don't try to eat your moisturizer. there's a Simpsons quote about that. Not to be taken internally.
Not to be
and Homer's like, because of me, now they have a warning. so there we go. So the short answer to your question, Margaret, is it's probably as good as every other moisturizer on the market.
That does it for listener questions. And now it's time for This Month in Pseudoscience. It's actually a very thank you for the jingle. It's actually a very short and quite positive news. Though there's always a specter of unintended consequences. I think we can discuss afterwards.
Yeah.
YouTube, aka the place we go to cry by seeing trending videos with hundreds of thousands of views with titles like Funniest Knockoff Brand Food and Jake Paul Sparring Footage Leaked.
Or where you go for spoiler reviews of Star Wars.
Indeed.
I haven't seen the movie yet.
AKA the second most popular website in the world, YouTube, starting in early December, they began enforcing new rules regarding dangerous pseudo-medical practices. It will ban videos promoting things like the Miracle Mineral Solution, or MMS, which was mentioned by the women we interviewed recently about fraudulent cures for autism. Black salve is also listed in the new YouTube policy. Black salve is an escharotic, so a paste that destroys your skin and leaves behind a scar. and it's promoted by some people as a miraculous treatment for cancer. It is not. It doesn't work. It's dangerous. It has left people mangled and disfigured. So this new policy will make it easier and faster in theory to have this content removed from YouTube. It has also had an interesting side effect. A woman who goes by Montreal Healthy Girl, about whom I've written for McGill, I've made a video about her, I've been interviewed in media coverage of her. She's a naturopath who was making very popular videos talking about how colloidal, not oatmeal, but silver, can cure AIDS, and how cancer is a warning sign that your body is too acidic, so you just need to start eating alkaline foods. She has essentially shut down her YouTube channel. It seems as if her channel would have been shut down by YouTube when these new rules would have been adopted, and so her content is gone. She is moving into some little-known platform, which most probably will not get the same traffic and exposure she was getting on YouTube. And before this shutdown, she was on a live stream with another dubious guru, and they were both complaining that so much of their recent content had been demonetized.
Well, this is actually becoming a big thing with YouTube now, right?
Because it is.
There's a new set of rules. I think it's called the COPPA compliance. It's basically, there was a Supreme Court decision in the U.S., and they basically said that YouTube was violating federal law because of advertising to children.
Mm-hmm.
So you're supposed to click a button when you sign up for YouTube saying, I'm over 13. But the Supreme Court recently said that's not good enough. And they saw that there were, you know, there's obviously a lot of kids on YouTube watching cartoons and videos and stuff. So basically now everybody who produces something on YouTube has to declare that their stuff is not being marketed to children.
Yeah,
and there's a
that.
List of criteria. Mm-hmm. And the list of criteria is actually very, very vague. It's like if you have music, if you have like animations, if your content matter could be interesting for children. So a lot of these like health people who are like family health and they talk about stuff to do with your kids, all of a sudden it's like, well, that's good advertising.
Right.
So if you declare that your stuff is not geared to children and YouTube finds that it is, they will fine you, and they will fine you thousands of dollars. And if you declare that it and you want to be safe, you're like, well, maybe children will watch it. They will demonetize you.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be taken out of the YouTube algorithm. They won't recommend your videos. People won't be able to leave comments. The community tab on YouTube, which I never use, is going to be taken off. So there's a lot of people on YouTube now who are abandoning the platform or who are worried that the platform is no longer going to be useful to them in terms of making money because of all these changes. And it really seems like YouTube is changing the rules of how they operate their system, because it used to be that it was like, everybody come to YouTube. And now it's like, maybe stay away.
Yeah, CBS come to YouTube, Fox News come to YouTube, but you know, independent content creators, not so much.
Yeah.
Now, coming back to this idea of banning, you know, videos about MMS and about Black Salve, I mean, I know that some people think any idea should be out there for the great battle of ideas, but some of these ideas are clearly dangerous and most people aren't trained to recognize them. And some amount of regulation is required, in my opinion. So I'm happy to see YouTube acting on this in particular. On the other hand, as YouTube has been cracking down more and more on this type of content, it also meant that people who have made skeptical videos informing the public about these topics, some of them have had their content removed as well. So we're unfortunately facing a situation where there's so much content out there that needs to be policed in some fashion, but apparently not enough people to do it. So the job is partly automated, but the AI is not good enough yet.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, any content, even if you're criticizing something, so even if you criticize something, because the computer is just looking for keywords, they'll take you off. So it's not a perfect system, because apparently policing the internet is quite hard.
Yeah, there was an entire episode of Radiolab, I believe, on Facebook moderation, and people in other countries that are watching really disgusting videos all day long, and the toll that it's taking on their mental health. Yeah. We have created a monster.
Yeah.
We want to thank our newest patrons, David McConnell, Stevie Shapiro, and Trimian Cassidy. We want to thank, of course, all of our patrons whom we love dearly, but especially those at the $5 a month or more level. And they are Jeff Brown, Marvin the Cat, Cape Speary, Jeff Gelbach, Ken Hale, Trimian Cassidy, Matthew Jacob, Islan Wolf MD, Frank R., Alan Matthews, Leanne Simon, Stevie Shapiro, Janice Stevenson, Ryan Armstrong, Luna Terra, Michael McAvoy, Helen Sue, Beverly Thunk, Eric Johnson, Cordelia Naismith, Pascal Levesque, Paul DeHaunt, Mary Ellen James, and that Montreal guy. If you enjoy what we do and would like to join these incredible people in contributing to the show, head over to patreon.com/thebodyofevidence. And that's the end of our show this month. Our Vox Popper was David Lawnstein on Twitter at Shecky Lean. Jingle by Joseph Hackle of the band Voodoo Jazz. Additional music by Seth Donnelly and by Kevin McLeod. His website is incompetech.com. Our theme music is Troll of the Mountain Swing by the Underscore Orchestra. Our illustrator who draws our cartoons is Luke Ouellette. If you want to support the show, find us on Patreon. All of our patrons get a bonus segment each month called Digressions. Our website is bodyofevidence.ca. The show itself can be found on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Stitcher. We are on Facebook and Instagram, and Chris and I have accounts on Twitter. And when trying to decide if a study is good or not, remember the Body of Evidence creed.
A study in mice is not a study in people.
Coincidences are easy, proving causation is hard.
Scientific studies are like movies. Some are just bad.
We can't stop at a single study. We have to look at
the body of evidence. Let's go.